Hello, welcome again to RTE's Your Politics podcast, our weekly look at politics from Leinster House.
There is trouble in paradise. The government parties have fallen out with each other.
No, we're only a year and a half in government.
In
terms of this arrangement.
There's a constant charge against me, because he has no case against us when it comes to
subs.
My charge against him is he's obsessed with innuendo and conspiracy theories.
There is something incredibly demoralising and abstract about this annual pantomime,
really. We're in the Houses of Parliament on national television.
Hello, you're very welcome again to another episode of RTE's Your Politics podcast. David Murphy, Paul Cunningham and Adele McAllister are with me. We're back in Leinster House and we've an interesting piece on the cost and benefit of going green to come for you. But as we speak this afternoon, Theresa May is back in Brussels asking the other 27 leaders, some would say begging, for just a little more time for her Brexit deal because it has been another extraordinary week.
What the government cannot legitimately do is to resubmit to the House the same proposition, or substantially the same proposition, as that of last week, which was rejected by 149 votes.
We just put off decisions and deadlines every couple of months. Brexit was never going to be clean, and Brexit would always require some very hard choices for the United Kingdom to make. It was never going to be all good and no bad.
What is important is that Parliament delivers on the result of the referendum and that we deliver Brexit for the British people. I sincerely hope that we can do that with a deal. I'm still working on ensuring that Parliament can agree a deal so that we can leave in an orderly way. What matters is that we deliver on the vote of the British people.
None of you is a traitor. All of you are doing your best. This should not be, and I'm sure will not prove, to be a matter of any controversy whatsoever.
A truly extraordinary week, and that's only the start of it, and it's likely to come to a head. For all that's going on in Brussels today, Paul, it's likely to come to head, not today, but in a week's time. This is just the preliminary to the final showdown.
Yeah, I mean, what we now see is that Theresa May, despite what the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, is saying, is going to bring back her meaningful vote, round three, to the Commons and try and see if it goes through this time. That's why it just seems so strange that when she did have an address to the nation, the very people who she's relying to put a deal through, those MPs, she went out and gave them a proverbial kick in the head, saying, it's all your fault, nothing to do with me. Me and the people on one side, you're on the wrong side. It was an extraordinary address. It just didn't make any political sense at all. But nonetheless, meaning of a vote, it goes to the House of Commons. And depending on that outcome, things then will move forward from there. If it goes through, it's a simple affair, bit of legislation through over the next coming weeks, Brexit happens, good night and good luck. As is far more likely, this gets voted down and then you're into territory. What will happen next?
She's determined to press on. It's going to go right to the wire, it looks like, David. But also Jeremy Corbyn this week, refusing to stay in the meeting with other opposition leaders when she did reach out across the House because Chuka Umunna was there. But also talking to Michel Barnier and teasing he could get a majority in the House of Commons. It'll be interesting to see whether he can step up to the plate in the week ahead.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was speaking to some people in the Irish Labour Party yesterday, and the sense I got from them was that Jeremy Corbyn is only after one thing, and that is a general election. And he really sees Brexit as a distraction, and he'd like that really just put to one side. The other thing that I've picked up is that he has also been in touch with the, or his party has been in touch with the Irish Labour Party, trying to get a sense of what happens when you're in government. From the Irish Labour Party, who obviously were in government in recent years. So that's the way the mindset is in the Labour Party. And it's as if they have this huge, big issue and they're trying to say, let's just leave that to one side for a moment and focus on maybe trying to get a general election. And really, that's what's imbued Jeremy Corbyn's outlook. I think that is part of the problem, that he doesn't see Brexit as being the issue that perhaps the rest of the United Kingdom sees it.
And one of the reasons he's able to push it to one side is because if you look back through his political career, he's always been opposed to the European Union. This is a man who doesn't agree with Britain's membership of the European Union. So he's quite happy for Brexit to happen because that is what he himself politically has always wanted. And the alternative that he's offering on you is a customs union. But once again, UK outside of the European Union, just maybe a little bit closer than Theresa May would like.
I'm still trying to figure out what the lessons the Irish Labour Party would have been passing on to the British Labour Party about being in government.
Yeah, I don't actually honestly have a great insight.
We all love to know.
Have a great insight on that. But judging by the impact on the Irish Labour Party after the last election, I'd say they'd have a couple of tips for him.
Just a couple of things in terms of the politics of this. From our point of view, we stand by helpless. Leo Varadkar, like the other leaders, saying there, you know, there has to be some kind of plan from the UK. But also Ireland being more conciliatory, say, you know, when you look at the French, when you look at other European countries, and this sense in Brussels that they're getting thoroughly fed up at this stage.
It's absolutely clear, and Emmanuel Macron, the French president, was out banging that drum today. But I think we in Ireland have to be extremely careful. No matter what happens in Brexit, the UK will be our nearest neighbour. It will be the most economically important. We do have all those ties. And so even though clearly the House of Commons is in a state of distress and the country is fighting between itself, it's something that Ireland has to be very, very careful. Because even if it is the case that we get the withdrawal agreement over the line in some shape or form, whether it's next week or in several months, you get into the hard part, which is the free trade agreement. And that's when there isn't going to be this big EU solidarity. Individual states are going to be scrapping with each other. And so in that case, we have to be very careful and we can't be grandstanding and watching the Brits looking down on them and saying, oh, what a mess. We have to be very careful indeed.
And it's not just Speaker Bercow who was causing problems for Mrs. May this week. She still wasn't able to secure the support of the DUP for the changes that she had managed to get from the EU on her withdrawal agreement. Question is, I suppose, this week, have the DUP missed their moment? Has Dodd's dithering cost them? Any thoughts?
I think it's interesting when you listen to some of the commentary that's coming from the North about the potential negative impact on the DUP of a hard Brexit. And there maybe is a sense that they've pushed it as hard as they can. And if they go any further, maybe that's too far. But if you look at the history of the DUP, they're not the party known for saying yes. They're the party known for saying no. And particularly if you look at its history in relation to the Good Friday Agreement, they've never really come out and said, actually, now's the right time. We're going to be positive.
I think there's just one thing to watch out for, and is the DUP must be looking at Jacob Rees-Mogg, who every second day comes out and says, well, I'll be guided by the DUP. And that would sense to be a sense of responsibility weighing on the shoulders of the DUP. In other words, if everything goes wrong, well, it was the DUP who couldn't find and strike a deal. And that must be unnerving them. If Brexit goes horribly wrong, you don't want to be left carrying the bit.
But it also raises the question is, why is he coming out and saying that? I mean, what's the advantage for him? And I think you're right, like there is a huge responsibility there that he's putting on their shoulders.
I think part of it is he's saying this is the Conservative and Unionist Party and one end of the family needs support and I'm extending that hand. That would be the benign version of it. The other one is to say, cripes, this could go horribly wrong. And if the blame is going to be shifted, let it be over your direction rather than mine.
Well, for the best on Brexit, we're going to leave Brexit at this stage, but you can always get more. And the essential listening is, of course, the Brexit Republic podcast with Tony Connolly and Colm O'Mahony.
This is pretty essential. As well. Come on now.
Yeah, but they are the best on Brexit. We do have to give them that. Let's talk about other matters. Actually, let's stay with Europe now and talk about what's been happening in the EPP, and the man that's called the Hungarian Trump, Viktor Orban, and his Fidesz party, the EPP. Give us the background to this and what's been happening, Paul.
Well, the European People's Party is the big centre-right bloc in the European Union, and there's lots of famous names there. Angela Merkel being one, Jean-Claude Juncker, Donald Tusk. This is a power centre and one of their members is the Fidesz party of Viktor Orban. And in Hungary, he's been taking an increasing authoritarian line. So if you happen to be, for example, campaigning for gay rights, you felt the sharp end. If you happen to be, say, an outside organisation like Transparency International, also getting accused of all sorts of things. If you happen to be in academia and opposed to the government. But that isn't the issue why the EPP is suddenly suddenly taken an interest in Hungary. It's the fact that posters were put up during a campaign in the run-up to the European elections with Jean-Claude Juncker's face on it and beside another bogeyman, George Soros, suggesting that immigration controls were going to be introduced and forced onto Hungary, which would see this gateway open and migrants flooding the country. And that's where the EPP said enough is enough. Complaint was made. We have to kick him out. But in many things political, it wasn't just as straight and simple as that. So rather than Fidesz being pushed out, they were voting rights were suspended with both the EPP leadership and Fidesz agreeing to the solution, and then a committee of wise men will assess it at some time and determine it in the future as to whether or not they should be kicked out full time. So a bit of politicking going on there. But one thing to finish off on is that Sinn Féin has been tracking this story for years. Luke Mink-Flanagan has been tracking this for years, continually pointing out that Enda Kenny, Fine Gael leader, EPP member, Leo Varadkar, EPP, have been saying they're going to take action but never did.
And of course, Sean Kelly has been very strong in speaking out against Viktor Orban's recent actions. So there's politics back and forth on that. But there's also politics in terms of what's going to happen to the new parliament and the EPP's power if they didn't have those votes from Fidesz.
Exactly. Like there used to be, there's a guy called Dáil, who used to be the head of the EPP bloc and Dáil. He's now the president of the bloc. And he's looking, as he was trying to manage this unfolding disaster, thinking, well, if Fidesz gets kicked out, then what do? They could move over to the some of the nationalist blocs that Nigel Farage's party are in. And this could cause problems because the rise of populism suggests that whole wing of the parliament is going to grow. The EPP will be weakened. And those 12 or 14 votes, well, maybe those Hungarian votes could be useful in times to come.
And watch that space. We'll be hearing more from you on that, Paul. But we're going to talk, I mean, obviously things European and things Brexit, you know, have all been dominating affairs here. But there has been have been a few developments happening on the political front. And one of them is this proposal for a gambling regulator. First of all, Adele McAllister, tell us what the proposal is.
Yes, oh yeah, this was a really, really significant announcement on the regulation of gambling. And what we have here is a bill, the Gambling Control Bill, which will, for the first time, it'll take in all forms of gambling, everything, your high street bookie, gaming machines, online gambling, gambling, spread betting, your poker casinos, everything will be subject to the scrutiny of a standalone office for independent gambling regulator. And it's really in line with other countries. So the proposals were launched this week by the government. It'll be financed by levies from the industry themselves will pay for it. Reports that backed up the publication of the bill this week suggests fines of up to 50,000. Included in the bill as well is a social fund that'll support research and treatment for those affected by problem gambling. And another part of the launch this week was to kind of update some of our gambling legislation, which is really goes back as far as the 20s and the 50s. And it's just to tidy up that and impose an 18-year age limit for all gambling. But essentially, the thrust of this is that we'll have a gambling regulator that will oversee all forms of gambling.
And likely to have wide support in the House, do you think?
Yes, we think at this stage that it will have cross-party support. Taoiseach said it would take about 18 months to establish. Fair to say, though, Áine, this has been a long time coming. The legislation that was initially published was in 2013. And I did put that to Minister of State David Staunton to ask how come it took so long. And he explained that so much has changed in this whole field. If you think about the proliferation of online gambling and how the whole industry has changed radically. And he explained that at the outset they had decided that a regulator would just be within the department, but then they soon realised this is a massive industry, and then there was the suggestion that it would be an independent regulator. Here's what he had to say.
I regret that delay, and a lot of us are very impatient to get this done, and I've said that in the both houses. What was proposed in 2013 was an office in the Department of Justice, and when I got this responsibility 2.5 years ago, we had a good long look at this and we decided that, you know, that's not strong enough, we need to go stronger, we need an independent regulator. It's a far bigger job than was envisaged back then. And so we set up an interdepartmental group which worked for the last 12 months on this. We looked at what was happening internationally, and we wanted to be up to date as well with our proposals.
And there was also support, Áine, just on that, from Fianna Fáil's Justice spokesperson Jim O'Callaghan. They tabled their own legislation, and he did sort of note that this was something that was really urgently needed.
When you think that it's such a large business with such negative consequences, it's surprising when you think of everything else we regulate that we don't regulate gambling, so I want to see it done promptly. Years ago, people could go to a bookie shop and they'd be guaranteed they were just going to lose the money in their pocket when they gambled badly. Now the situation is much different. You have people, young people particularly, who are gambling online. They're given huge credit by gambling companies and they lose vast amounts of money. Their lives can be transformed over a matter of hours.
So that sounds like there's a reasonably welcome sentiment, I suppose, in the House. We'll see how the legislation goes through. What about the industry reaction, Adele?
Yeah, I mean, broad support for this, Áine. The Irish Bookmakers Association say they have been waiting for a regulator. They said that they wanted to see a regulator up and running, and they say the sooner the better. And also groups that work with people with gambling addictions and gambling problems, they also welcome it, in particular the social fund that will support treatment and research.
Mm-hmm. I mean, gambling is huge business in this country, David Murphy, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge market, and we do have gambling companies or betting companies becoming larger and larger, particularly following the merger of Betfair and Paddy Power. But I think to a certain extent, there was an industry within an industry here, which was entirely unregulated, and that was the spread betting industry. And it's an industry which exists on people's laptops, on their phones, and it's different to normal gambling in the sense that you can, in normal gambling, you might go in with 10 or 15 euro, you put it on the horse. If the horse doesn't come in, you lose your 10 or 15 euro. But with spread betting, effectively, you give a credit card number. And the extent of your liability can escalate very, very quickly over a number of days. And it's entirely unregulated. Many people have had a lot of reservations about how it's operated. So I think it's certainly welcome that the government has taken the first steps to at least have a regulator. I think the time lag is going to be something of a concern for people. Also, potentially we're going to have a general election within the time frame they're talking about in terms of setting this up. So you'd really hope that after the next general election, whoever takes up the reins of office would ensure that this regulator is put in place.
And a question as well about implementation. I mean, it's one thing to pass the law, it's another to implement it. And so much betting being online, that ain't going to be easy.
It isn't going to be easy. How are you going to police this? How are you going to make sure that everybody who is operating in this market is licensed? And you've got to remember as well, many of the people offering services in this market don't have a physical presence here. And that's something, an issue that regulators like the central bank have come up against again and again.
All right. Another one we'll be keeping an eye on. Adele, you've been checking out. We were all out celebrating for St. Patrick's Day, of course, and the weather shone here, which was absolutely marvellous. But of course, we'll all have seen all around the world, it's not just a big day here and this global greening, the Eiffel Tower going green, all kinds of buildings all over the world going green, the Great Wall of China going green. There's a cost to this. And there's also the cost of the benefit. You've been checking these sums out.
Yeah, that's right, Áine. Yeah, we've all seen the fantastic images of the global greening around the globe. And we asked Tourism Ireland, who run the project, just how much does it cost and what do we get out of it? The cost of running the scheme is just over 48,500 euro. But it generates, they estimate, on a conservative basis, around 10 million euro in coverage. So that's if they were to try and buy all the advertising space that we've received by that in, say, print, online, broadcast, that's what we would have paid, 10 million. So it really is a good news story. And it's extraordinary. We were just talking about this in the office as we were writing up this story. And it is extraordinary that we have that level of goodwill. This is in 55 countries. And we now have, I think, more than 400 places. So it's everything. Niagara Falls, Colosseum in Rome, Empire State Building in New York, and like even lots of smaller venues around Europe, across the globe and across a lot of the continents. It's extraordinary, isn't it, that there's so much goodwill towards getting this project up and running. Now, the CEO of Tourism Ireland, Niall Gibbons, paid tribute to the diaspora. So, and I think really that in effect is and also the network of embassies around the world, that's what it's Irish people around the world facilitating all of this coverage.
the green global footprint, David?
So I road tested this last weekend, you'll be glad to hear. So I was in Belgrade, which is slightly unusual in terms of diaspora because there's less than 100 Irish people living there. And there were five public buildings lit up in green. I went out for a drink, everyone's pints, they were all green. And it's amazing to see how in a country where there isn't really that much Irish influence, in the capital, that St. Patrick's Day, you know, they're toasting our patron saint on the day. So yeah, it's quite a remarkable marketing coup that essentially the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Tourism Authority in Ireland have come up with. It's, you know, certainly Ireland is getting good bang for its buck.
And I think it's right in political terms to continue to use it and continue to expand it. I remember a number of years ago when Eamon Ryan was the Minister for Energy, he was leading a trade mission around sort of Silicon Valley at St. Patrick's Day. And for one afternoon, we were walking down the middle of the main street in San Francisco and the entire city had shut down. And it is just amazing to see, knowing that's been replicated in city and city in the United States, in country after country after country. And so it's probably unpopular at times, but I'd be a very strong supporter of the cabinet continuing to make those trips abroad, continuing to use St. Patrick's Day to get some form of economic leverage for trade. And just shows you got an awful lot of bang for your buck just out of the green lights too.
We sound like a bored fodge ad, don't we? But actually, fair play to everyone involved, because it does produce a huge return. And as you say, the impact, the marketing for Ireland all over the world, it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, they have been using it actually to push their message on Brexit this week, which has been very opportune considering how close they're coming to the 29th of March.
It wasn't without reason that Simon Coveney wasn't in Japan. He was coasting around the Netherlands and Belgium in case he needed to make a quick hop home.
OK, well, hopefully by the time we talk to you next week, there might be something approaching a crisis, a revolution or a resolution, a revolution or else a disaster one way or another. We'll be keeping you in touch. As I say, there's always Brexit Republic. And just to say, we'll be talking to you again next week. Thanks to all the team and thanks to Jack Good on production. Till we talk to you again. Sláinte.